Now, Andy and Phil are going to come and talk to us in a minute or two. Just before we pray for them, let's remind you of something. I sort of wanted to show a picture from over 10 years back, I think it was 1998, of Andy and Phil standing up one summer with a map of Wiltshire where they talked about prayer for the county. And in a way, that sums up for me one of the contributions, only one of the contributions they've made in the long term. Time and again, they've drawn us back to the county. And we're back with it again. And it was this summer, on the 15th of June, that Andy wrote to WhatsApp the core team with something about this concept of rewilding. And to be honest, because I checked who else had responded to it, nobody knew much what to do with it. At that particular juncture, I'm not sure that Andy knew what to do with it as well, but he had faithfully flagged it as a matter of interest. So, number one, 1998. Number two, June the 15th. Number three, I'm travelling with my grandson back from Cardiff, and he's talking about the Welsh flag, and said to me, that asked me, does Wiltshire have a flag? And we looked up the Wiltshire, he looked up the Wiltshire flag because I was driving, and said, there's this funny dragon sort of thing in the middle of the flag. And I said to him, well, that must be a griffin, a mythical creature, which just stayed there. And then I was reading somebody called Martin Scott about how sometimes when you see the symbol of an area and the flag of an area, it can help you with praying. And I thought, that's interesting. Let's have a look at this Wiltshire flag again. And this Wiltshire flag does not have a griffin on it. Some of you will know what it has. What does it have? The last great bastard was shot in 1832. The year of the Great Reform Act. And for ages now, they've been trying to get great bastards back on Salisbury Plain, which has been yet another one of Andy's focuses. I can't remember where it was, but it was certainly before we redid our house, because the shape of the room that Andy brought a word about, it was you and the baby in the middle of the, yeah. And about the emptiness of the Salisbury Plain, and that's been one of the things that he's brought to us. Now, this is real tough stuff. And so, here we are again, and last week, these guys, Pete and Kath, were late with the news, but came back with the rewilding thing again. And we had that 10-minute video. Now, they claim not to have seen your source, didn't they? Yeah. They said, oh, we had it from a different source, which actually increases the impact. So I am looking forward to what these guys are going to say today. I think it hopefully will raise questions as well as answers. And I'm hoping and believing that it's going to... I'm trying to find a word, but the word is tip us. Yeah, tip us into something that we haven't anticipated. Father, we pray that we will see the prophetic voice in action this morning. Amen. Who's going first?
Thank you. Right. Okay. Thanks for that, Dave. Pete and Kath, we're going to try and recap because some of you guys weren't here last week. So Phil and I have tried to do like one of those Netflix programs where you get a bit of a recap first and then we'll go on to where we think we are. So there's, just so you know, they showed an 8-minute video last week. What we've done is chopped it into 4 bits so that it's short and we're just going to comment a little bit after each one. And there will be some interaction, I'm afraid, towards the end. So, you know, get your shields up ready for that. So, whatever. Okay, so can you show that first, guys?
All across the UK, more and more land is being given back to nature. Farmers are putting away their ploughs, gardeners are putting away their mowers, and just letting nature do what nature does best. This is an approach to nature conservation which is often called wilding or rewilding. And essentially it's a passive way of managing the landscape. You take your hands off, you go with nature. Essentially, it's a way of restoring habitats, a way of expanding ecosystems, and a way of allowing nature to return. Kind of struck me. What if we did this to the church? What if we rewilded the church? What if we took our hands off and instead of absorbing people in centralized programs, instead orientated them the other way around and say, what does God want for you in your local context? What has He created you to be? What passions has He put in your heart? How does He want to use you to connect with those who don't know Jesus? Maybe it's time to rewild the church.
Dave said that I actually picked up this thing in June. It was a report from the CMS Pioneer Leaders thing, and it was talking about this particular project that had happened at the Knepp Castle Estate, which is near central London. It's a big farm, 3,500 acres, and there's a whole big report about it. And they started rewilding their farm in around 20 years ago, and it was a big sort of project for them. So I'm just going to read a little bit about what they did. It's an article actually that was published in the Daily Mail about them, and I've chosen it really because it's just easy to listen to rather than reading a bit of the report, which wouldn't be so easy to listen to. So it says, Isabella Tree is the wife of the couple that are actually running the farm. Said, with breathtaking speed, thickets of 3-foot-high thistles were advancing over the ground, engulfing acre after acre. It was like the day of the Triffids. Every day, as my husband Charlie and I walked over what had once been arable fields on our family farm, we could barely believe what we were seeing. Not for nothing is this creeping weed known as the cursed thistle. It sends out deep tap roots, and as any gardener knows, it's almost impossible to dig out. And in our case, however, using weed killer was out of the question. We were several years into a pioneering project to rewild the land. We were no longer willing to use the pesticides, fungicides, and artificial fertilizers that had once seemed so essential. Knepp Castle Estate is just 45 miles from central London, and though you wouldn't know it, thorny scrub, hawthorn, blackthorn, dog rose, and bramble has punched through fields that had only a few years earlier were blanketed with maize and barley. Giving up intensive farming on our 3,500 acres has been a very difficult but unavoidable decision on desperately poor soil, which is heavy clay. We rarely made a profit and had worked up an eye-watering overdraft. Inspired by our rewilding experiment in Holland, we'd sold our dairy herds and farm machinery, stepped back, and allowed nature to take the driving seat, the first project of its kind in Britain. This did not go down well with many of our neighbours, who complained that it was an immoral waste of land, an eyesore full of weeds and brambles, and now the great thistle invasion seemed to be proving them right. Had we been hopelessly naive? Was this the end of our vision to establish a patch of self-wilded nature, a messy, rambunctious mini-wilderness in the heart of West Sussex? Just when all seemed lost, out of a clear blue sky came a very different invasion. That warm, clear Sunday morning in May 2009, we woke up to see painted lady butterflies streaming past our bedroom window at the rate of about one a minute. Outside, thousands upon thousands of them had descended on the swathes of creeping thistle to lay their eggs. As we approached, our dogs ran into the prickly cover, sending up puffs of orange and brown wings like autumn leaves. We walked for half an hour that morning, parting curtains of butterflies. A few weeks later, spiky black caterpillars were swarming over the thistles, spinning silken webs like tents. The whole area took on the appearance of a chaotic army encampment. By autumn, the caterpillars had wolfed down the leaves, pupated, and flown away, leaving our thistle fields in tatters. The following year, our 60 acres of creeping thistle had vanished entirely. Not only had nature solved the thistle problem, but thanks to sitting on our hands, we'd been given a ringside seat at one of its greatest spectacles. So I wanted to tell you that story because the nature thing of the whole project was letting nature actually take its own pace. Of course, they had loads of other stuff happen, like they've sort of alluded to, lots of brambles and lots of things going on. They also introduced longhorn cattle, Exmoor ponies and pigs, and they all did their different thing around the estate. But one of the other things that's happened is that conservationists and ecologists have started to focus in on this farm because they started to see massive numbers of wildlife in numbers and stuff that they didn't really believe could happen. There were big, big surprises. So I'm just going to tell you one story of this, which is about turtle doves. Apparently, turtle doves in Britain have been dropping massively over the last sort of 30 or 40 years. They've dropped by about 95% in numbers. So they never had turtle doves on the Knepp estate whilst they were an arable farm. But as their rewilding project has gone on, turtle doves have come into the estate, and they've got, they think, they call it 20 singing male turtle doves because it's difficult, they're quite difficult to spot. They think they've got around 16 breeding pairs on the estate, which is a huge number compared to zero before and obviously, you know, to the rest of the country. But the thing that the RSPB said was, well, if you want to attract turtle doves, because they said, first of all, they nest in old woodland and they eat grain. And so you need to put out all sorts of grain to attract turtle doves. And of course, this couple didn't do that. They just said, no, we're not doing that. We've already got the turtle doves arriving. They're already coming. So something else must be happening because we haven't put any grain out for them. And then they began to find that the turtle doves didn't nest in old woodland, mature woodland, but it nested in new trees. And apparently a turtle dove calls a nest two twigs crossed over. That's about it. It's a very sort of skimpy sort of nest. But basically they were living in, they were nesting in new, you know, young trees. And also they didn't eat grain because there wasn't any grain on their farm. So, and they've discovered that grain actually is very bad for turtle doves because it cuts the throat or it absorbs moisture when they're inside and it's not very good for them. So they were wondering what they did eat, and they found that they were eating, when they arrived, because they're a migratory bird from the Mediterranean, when they arrive, they're quite tired and they wondered what on earth they were eating. And they found that they were eating grubs and worms and little larvae and all sorts of bits and pieces like that. And then at the end of their summer, just before September, there's a weed that grows with loads of seeds on it, which they eat quite a lot, and then they obviously migrate again. The thing was, the RSPB were looking at what had happened in the 1950s. In the 1950s, arable land across the nation changed because of industrialization. And so basically, you have what you can look at in Wiltshire and see it pretty much. It's woodland and it's farmland. And the turtle doves were eating the grain and living in the tree, the mature trees, because there was no option. They also found out that when the turtle doves eat what they actually, you know, want to eat, if you like, that's available in the natural environment that they've got at Knepp Estate, their lifespan doubles. So I thought it was quite an interesting little story, really. I mean, Pete actually told me that story last week, which I've sort of looked to check up on. It's also linked in a bit. There's also an issue with nightingales that do similar sort of thing, apparently. But it does actually give us an indication that, as church, if we only look back at one particular way of doing it, you know, that's a short... Anyway, we'll come to that in a little minute. We'll have a little think about that. So what we're going to do now is going to look at the next bit of video and look at one other thing to provoke your thoughts, I think. Yeah.
So what does the Wilded Church look like? Well, I think the Wilded Church is a place that gives room intentionally for seeds to grow. It's a place where you allow every species to flourish according to how it was created to be. It's a space where you allow artists to be artists and attract other artists. It's a space where you allow potters to do what they do best and attract other potters. It's a space where different forms of contextual church emerge. But as leadership, we don't predict or necessarily control the shape that they emerge in. We oversee them, we make sure that they're spiritually healthy, but we allow them to flourish in the way that is best going to spread the kingdom.
Okay. Right, so 5 years ago, I had the seed of an idea. I'd read a book by Sarah Miles, which was called Take This Bread. And Dave Halls had put some articles my way about people doing dinner church in America. I was very attracted to this idea. I thought, this sounds really, really good. It sounded something that was easy to do, and I was desperate to give it a go, basically. But we talked about it and we had conversations, but at the time I just didn't feel like I had permission to take it any further, so I put it down. Then, as you know, well, Andy and I have run loads of alphas in the past, but in January this year we did another alpha in our home, and it was a great success. We had a really super group meeting together every week. But the trouble with alpha, the recurring problem we've always had, is what do you do post alpha? Alpha, I don't know if everybody's familiar with Alpha, the Alpha course, but Alpha is great because you meet together every week, you have a meal together, you watch a video, and then people can ask any question they like about the Christian faith. It's a really good evening. People make friends and have fun together. But once Alpha's finished, you know, for following that up, because the resources for Alpha that Holy Trinity Brompton produce are so such high quality, anything that you put on subsequent to that seems pretty naff, to be honest. And so we've always struggled to do something to follow up that will provide good opportunity for people to be discipled and carry on in their new faith. So, but anyway, halfway through this Alpha, we started to think about, oh, what are we going to do to follow up? And I just thought, oh, dinner church. This is the opportunity we've got now to do. So we've already got a group of people we know like eating together. So I floated the idea with the group. What about if we, when Alpha comes to an end, that we don't give up meeting, but we carry on, and it changes in that instead of me serving the food up every week, everyone takes a parcel. You know, we divide up the meal and everyone brings a part of the meal, and we carry on sharing and praying together, but around the table we have bread and wine, so we share the break bread together every week, and everyone was really up for it, so that's what we did. So we started dinner church, breaking bread, remembering Jesus around the table, having our meal together, and exploring the Bible as well and learning to pray. And Greg and Laura were part of that, and I've invited them to come up and share what Dinner Church means to them. Do you want to sit down? Do I have to use the microphone? Who's going first?
I wondered if that was going to happen. So how do you want to do this? Are you asking me questions, or do you just want me to say?
Well, my question is, how has it been for you?
Okay. I'm getting fat, for a start. Fatter, thank you, love. No, it's great, actually. It's really nice to meet together every week. I've made some good friends. But what struck me last week was Pete and Kath mentioned a passage in Acts 2. There's four things that the early church did, which was devoting themselves to the teachings of the apostles, fellowship, breaking of bread, and prayer. And that struck me quite hard, because that is exactly what we do. You know, every week we meet together, that fellowship, we talk, we've become friends, we know each other's lives, we know each other's kids, we know what's happening. We know whether Mandy's changed her job again, which happens quite a lot. And then we'll eat together, we have a meal, and most of us contribute, some of us less than others. We'll have the meal, then...
That was pointed at Andy, by the way, because yeah. He's only ever made custard.
Andy does custard.
But it's the best custard. That's all he needs to do.
However, I haven't brought anything food-wise yet, because I can't cook very well, so I'm not... And we always break bread. Somebody usually makes it now, which is getting quite nice. We get nice bread. We break bread together every week. We drink the wine together, although it's not wine because some of us don't like wine. And we'll pray for each other. We'll discuss who needs prayer for what, where you are in your life, how you feel, what you need prayer for, and we'll pray for each other. And also there will be some teaching. We've been working our way through Ephesians, so we've been devoting ourselves to the Acts, to the teaching of the apostles, and it's a fantastic evening, really. I thoroughly enjoy it. So I'm going to pass you over and see if Laura can come at it from a totally different direction, because I'm sure she will.
For me, the thing that's really been quite interesting about Dinner Church, we went at it's very informal. I think none of us really knew quite how it was going to work out. There was a skeleton of an idea, but quite how that was going to shape up was interesting to watch. But because we'd got to know each other over sort of a couple of months already, we weren't starting from cold. And there seemed to be something about sitting around a table with people, sharing really good food, that opened people up. And like Greg said, people started to talk about what their problems might be at that time, if they were worried about something, if their kids had an issue. Some stories were dramatic, some stories less so, thankfully. And that then gave us the opportunity to obviously pray for each other, not only that night, but during the week as well. And slowly people started to get to know each other. Slowly people started to be more open. And now, yeah, we really do know each other. It's a really close-knit little group. There's huge amounts of support for one another. One of the things that I've noticed is that something comes up every few weeks where you've got a new angle on something from the Bible, or somebody learns something. There just seems to be a development. We're all growing, which is really rewarding to see. And it's that intimacy of that small group. Just there's normally about 10 of us, aren't there, that really enables that to take place. We've had our children have come along regularly now, which is amazing because they've never been involved in the church. And some of the other children come along, every now and again, which is just fantastic. So it's really, I think, as I say, the value is in that informal, relaxed, intimate setting And I think a lot of the people who've come along maybe wouldn't have come along initially straight to church because they'd have found it a bit intimidating. But by getting to know sort of 8 or 10 people to start with, church doesn't seem quite so daunting. And because there's no pressure, everyone can just ask questions. People are able to explore and sort of turn things over in their minds and work out what they think about things without feeling they have to agree. And that then gives all of us an opportunity to learn. We're all learning from one another. Different people think in different ways, so we're all looking at things from different angles, which has been fantastic for all of us. So, yeah, it's been an experiment that's really worked. Yeah. And we're all getting fatter.
Thank you.
Like Laura said, I had my initial idea, but once Dinner Church started, it was really interesting seeing how it evolved or it grew. And I want to share a bit of a struggle that I had at the beginning, because it wasn't happening like I thought it would, and it made me think of the turtle dove story, because in my head I thought when we broke bread around the table it would be in a certain way, because I suppose I've been brought up an Anglican, and you know, like, we have a very lovely way of breaking bread in Dayspring, and I thought there would be a similar sort of feel to it when we did it at Dinner Church, but I had my idea, like, the turtle doves should live in these trees and eat grain, but when it actually happened at Dinner Church, it happened differently. And I remember what the first time, I think we went round to Greg and Laura's house for dinner, and I think it was the first time your cat and Chris joined us. We had the table outside because it was summer, and we could fit everyone around the table that way. and Laura had the she'd poured the red grape juice into this jug, which a beautiful jug, right to the top, and. We pass the jug around and say, fill up each other's glasses, saying, you know, the body of the blood of Jesus poured out for you, Andy or whoever, and pass the jug around. Of course, it was absolutely impossible to pour from this jug. All the juice was just going everywhere. It was spilling all over the table. Everybody was laughing, and there was banter, and there was chatter, and inside I'm going, oh, I don't know if this is right. Should it really be like this? And I'm having this internal struggle, and I feel like Jesus is sitting next to me. And I almost, when I didn't hear his, I didn't, you know, it's not an audible voice, but it's. I just felt Jesus saying, "This is fine. This is why my blood has been spilled out, so that people can sit round a table and be in this kind of freedom of friendship and." Loving one another and having this kind of joyful occasion. This is why it was spilt. So I am having to put away my religious ideas about breaking of bread, and I'm finding I'm meeting Jesus at the table much, much more than I ever imagined I would. I have seen, so when we gather around the table, we've sat round the table at Bluebell Wood. Where is it? We went for a walk. Westwoods. We sat round this table, and it went dark while we were sitting. Greg had bought his lamps, and so our little table was lit up as it went dark. But the intimacy and the friendship and the, but it's not only that, it's the sense of Jesus with us. Because it doesn't happen just otherwise. You know, what I'm saying is I just think that we have, I have found going back to the Acts 2 experience really, really challenging. And I have had to feel like I have to sit on my hands, not to say anything. This is okay. It's all right to let this happen. And things grow back better than they were. It's better than I thought it would be. Is that where we stop for the next bit? Thank you.
I think we're doing the next video, so. Yep. Third one, this, isn't it?
Yeah. And in Isaiah 41, we read of that. God said, "The poor and needy search for water, but there is none. Their tongues are parched with thirst, but I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will make rivers flow on barren heights and springs within the valleys. I will turn the desert into pools of water and the parched ground into springs. I will put in the desert the cedar and the acacia, the myrtle and the olive. I will set junipers in the wasteland, the fir and the cypress together, so that people may see and know, may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created it." What we see in that scripture is the return of wildlife, the return of life to landscapes that have been barren for such a long time. And this whole concept of wilding just gives us a lens through which we can understand how the church could be today. You know, we want to see our villages and our communities restored. We want to see living water flowing through them. And we're not going to do that just on Sunday mornings. It's going to take a whole load of creator-driven expressions of contextual church. And it all starts with each and every one of us lifting our hands in prayer and just asking God, "God, what are you up to in my context? Why have you put me here? What is it that you wanted me to join in with?"
And so, coming to the bit that I actually found originally, which was from the CMS Pioneer thing, this guy was talking about, he started to write an article, and instead of saying rewilding, he talked about wilding. Rewilding is for the agricultural situation, but he talked about wilding the church, which is what this guy's just done as well. He said it, and he says this, "And it is wilding, not rewilding, that we must enable. The wild spirit of God is not our utility to be employed for our aims and purposes. Besides, our memories are too short. Rewilding, in ecological terms, is frequently prey to the effect of the shifting baseline. That is the baseline of biodiversity that we've experienced." And that would be, I mean, for me, I might remember lots and lots of butterflies flying around, and so on, big clouds of butterflies and stuff when I was young. But that'd be nothing compared to the diversity, say, from before industrialization. And in a similar way, we may refer to a baseline of full churches on Sunday and a well-attended Sunday school and a host of Bible study groups. But that was then. And now the context may have changed radically. Rewilding might be a nostalgic project to restore a vision of the past, but wilding is a willingness to cooperate with the emerging vision of nature or of the spirit. So wilding invites humans to be facilitators of the vision of nature or of the spirit. In this model, our role is as observers, enablers, and curators. Surprise, which Philip has had as well as was in the NEP, the NEP estate, with the experience of species returning in unexpected numbers and unexpected places, just as those at NEP might have said, "Yes, that's a nightingale, but we never expected to breed here." We might then say, "Yes, that's church, but we never expected it to look like that." And I love that bit. We never expected it to look like that, because I think for both me and Phil, the dinner church thing has been a real boost in a way, because it's sort of done things that we haven't expected. We didn't expect that Greg and Laura's, by the way, Greg and Laura's children aren't little children, 23 and 20. 24, sorry, she is now. 24 and 20. And also Maria's daughter's 16, and also Mandy's, both two of Mandy's children, one who's 19 and the other one who's 16, have come. And they have been brilliant when they've come, because they've asked questions that have just enlivened the group, and well, enlivened it in the sense that it really made us think, and then had to really try and wrestle with the questions and see if we've answered the question. It's just been a really, really good sort of life thing happening. I mean, we could talk more on that, but I don't think there's necessarily too much time for that this morning. But what we wanted to do was to see, Philippa talked about having a buried seed. And I just wondered whether, with the rewilding thing, of course, there was loads of seeds that were buried across the estate that then just sprang up when they were given the opportunity. And I just think that maybe there's some here this morning. And wondered whether you'd like to just have a chat with the people near you, maybe in three or four or five people in a group or whatever, or something like that. It doesn't have to be exact. And just sort of see if something's actually clicked off in you or popped in you now that sort of says, oh, you know, if any church could be like, and you just share that, or you, if you haven't got something like that, that you just share your response to this as to whether you think, well, no, I think that's no good, or, yeah, that would be quite good, but I don't know how to do it. You know, just sort of, you've got a 2 or 3 minutes to just have a...
And lots of Pete's examples were where people had seen...
It's I'm bound at any point we interrupt, it's going to be an interruption. So, if you... just being gentle. Yeah. No. I'm trying to back off that, but yeah. When we're, we want to show you another little thing, because some of the, there's never enough time to talk about this. You've got to create your own time to talk about it in the end. Otherwise, you know, I know, I'm sorry to stop the conversation really, because it's great to see you all doing that. We've got the next bit of the video, which I think gives us a pointer as to not only about having ideas and feeling something is going on and stuff, but also gives us a bit of a way forward, which is pretty obvious to Christians. But let's just hear what he's got to say, and then we'll just wind up after that a little bit.
So how do you wild a church? Well, I really think it all starts in prayer. Gather people from your community or your village, or it might be your local context. You know, gather your musicians, your artists, your potters, whatever it might be, and just get them together and pray. And it might be helpful to pray in four different ways. First of all, pray up. Just thank God for who he is, for his character, for his nature. Thank him for Jesus. Thank you for his forgiveness over your life, for his daily provision, for his care. Thank him for friends and family and all the good things in your lives. And then secondly, pray outwards. Pray for your context and your community, for your schools, for your libraries, for your doctor surgeries, whatever it might be. Just give thanks for them and ask God to bless them. And then thirdly, pray for each other. Pray for all of the stuff that needs dealing with. Pray to be filled with the Holy Spirit. Pray to be full of his life and his vision. And then fourthly, just ask God some questions. God, what are you doing in my context, in my community? And how can I join in?
So we wanted to just pray, really. And so we thought we'd... You're going to say something about this, aren't you?
I just... Well, I think we could pray now. We thought we could perhaps have a more longer prayer time, but we've used up the time differently. I thought maybe with the people that you've just been chatting with, that you could just thank God for the things that have been shared and maybe ask God those questions. If you haven't got any idea of how, you know, this might work out in your life, ask, or no idea of what God's doing in your community, then ask him now. Start the question. Start the ball rolling. And if you are beginning to be excited about something, keep talking about it. Don't bury it. Keep talking about it. Bore people with your ideas. Let's see what God does.
You're probably right. Most certainly, if you're feeling something that's happening and you feel that God's in, you're going to be right. So be confident about that. So what you talked about, it might not turn out like Phil thought she was right about dinner church, but it hasn't worked out exactly like she thought it was going to. But that's the way things roll, isn't it, really? We're just going to end with you guys praying, really. But I do want to say there's a really good film. I can't remember. It's one with Hugh Grant. It's about a boy, I think it's called. And they end up saying, we all need backup. And we have a lot of backup, really, in church because we're a community. And we need backup about this. So talk about it as well as pray about it, I think. So if you've got something, keep talking. Talk to people, get their views, talk about it, talk to God about it, keep asking him the questions. And I think it will end up sort of cross-fertilizing ideas and stuff. Because that happened for me with pop-up church, doing pop-up church over at Hullavington, because Dave Sandberg set us off doing pizza evenings, and I sort of wanted to do that. I can't tell you that story now, but pizza evenings helped me think about how I could do pop-up church. So, you know, there will be different things that happen along the way. So why don't we just get into our groups again and just pray and start to ask God what you're doing and start to fight, you know, just push it a little bit.
Yeah.
Do it. Yeah.